Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Happy 2008, the 50th year since the Cuban Revolution. Despite a U.S. embargo for most of those years, and according to one count, 683 assassination attempts, Fidel Castro is still there and calling the shots about his succession. They say winners write history, and he's taking his shot at it in the form of a spoken autobiography called Fidel Castro, My Life, based on a series of interviews with French journalist Ignacio Ramonet. It's being published here this month, and to talk about the book and Castro's legacy, I'm joined now by Peter Kornbluh. He's the director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives. That's an independent research organization that advocates the publication of classified documents. He selected and edited an excerpt from the book that'll be published in The Nation magazine this week. Peter Kornbluh, welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Brian.
So before we get into Castro and the complexities of his legacy, who is Ignacio Ramonet, the journalist who interviewed Castro for this book?
Well, he's actually a Spaniard who was educated in France and is the editor-in-chief of the very prestigious Le Monde Diplomatique. He's written widely on Latin America. He's spent some time in Cuba, and he actually convinced Castro in 2003 to sit down for what became 100 hours of interviews that covered all of Castro's life, the Cuban Revolution, his perspective on the world, on what's going on in the world today, and what's going on in Cuba today. From those interviews came what is being billed as a not an interview book, but an autobiography, a spoken autobiography, which I have to say is kind of appropriate given that one of the things that is so well known about Fidel Castro is how much he talks. But it is a very comprehensive, detailed, spoken view of his life and his participation in this history over the last so many years.
And given how much he talks, I wonder if in your reading of the book, there is a lot of news here. Did you learn much about Castro, or at least Castro's version of Castro, from reading this?
Well, I learned a lot about his early life as a young child, growing up in Biran, one of the provinces of Cuba, being sent off to school, to boarding schools at a very early age, kind of where his early rebellious nature came from, details of his involvement at the university and his first forays abroad as a law student, where he spent less time studying law and more time involved in kind of international student movement work. There is a very interesting chapter which he actually added after the Spanish version came out. The book came out in Spanish over a year ago, but he read it while he was sick and kind of re-edited it and added some parts. And one of the parts he added was this rather extraordinary story, which will appear in The Nation magazine later this week, of his role with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela during the aborted April 2002 coup, where Castro was on the phone with Chavez when Chavez was under siege, counseling him not to kind of fight to the death, but rather to surrender and build time for his forces to gather and for the kind of popular demonstrations to begin to bring him back to power. And in fact, in 48 hours, Chavez was able to resume power. And that's a story that hasn't really been told in English before and is not widely known. And it's quite interesting.
And that's the segment from the book that you decided to publish as a magazine excerpt in The Nation.
That's right. That was before, I have to say, all the issues of Castro kind of saying publicly that he would not cling to power and might yield to younger generations came up. And the book has a whole kind of last chapter titled After Fidel What, in which Castro does very specifically talk about successions to the next generations, and I think it's quite relevant to the kind of the media focus that's on Cuba today, which is, you know, is Castro going to kind of retire, and to who is the baton going to be passed?
And listeners, we do want you in on this. Why is Castro such a polarizing figure? Have you changed your view about Castro over time? Has your view become more nuanced or more entrenched about Castro as time has passed? Give us a call about Fidel Castro. Cuban Americans listening, especially invited to call in, but anyone may. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If any Cuban Americans do happen to be listening right now, do you feel differently about Castro from your parents, perhaps? If you're a younger Cuban American, did your parents come over here and you feel exactly the same way that they do, or maybe a little different? But anyone on Castro and his legacy at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show as we talk to Peter Kornbluh from the National Security Archives, who's been looking over this book called Fidel Castro, My Life, based on a series of interviews between Castro and a French journalist. 212-433-WNYC to bury Castro or to praise him. 212-433-9692. Though, of course, he's not dead yet. And I wonder what you make, Peter, of what is next in Cuba. He did have these hints, I guess you'd call them. They're not really quite declarations, that he wouldn't cling to power forever. And he's already turned over the job of the presidency to his brother Raul because he's been sick. So who's in charge of Cuba right now? And is it clear what would happen if Castro dies?
Well, Raul Castro did step up to be president, acting president, in late July of 2006 when Fidel Castro suddenly announced that he had to undergo surgery for an intestinal issue, which turned out to be diverticulitis. And Raul has been in charge since then, and the succession has gone rather smoothly. There's been no popular outcry. There's been no protests in the streets, and no kind of infighting that one can see. So from the Cuban perspective, I think they've planned for this for many years. And Castro actually, in the last chapter of this book, says that they had to plan for a succession for all these years because of the constant threat of assassination against him. But in the last chapter of his book, he points out that if something happens to him tomorrow, then Raul would obviously be the person to succeed him. But as he points out, but he's catching up to me in years, so there's also a generational problem. And he talks about the need for a younger generation to succeed the generation that both he and Raul are a part of. And I believe they've both been grooming disciples of the Cuban Revolution who are somewhat younger, in their 40s and 50s, to step up eventually and run Cuba.
So before we take some phone calls, and I don't know if it surprises you or not that our phones are exploding with people who want to talk about Castro, let me ask you one thing. From your sense of him from reading this spoken autobiography, does he grapple with the paradox of being a dictator for life while espousing power to the people? Does he believe democracy is ultimately just not in the people's interest?
Well, I spent a lot of personal time with him as well. I've actually even heard some of the stories that he tells in this book when I was organizing a 40th anniversary conference on the Bay of Pigs invasion, and another 40th anniversary conference on the Cuban Missile Crisis in 2001 and 2002. The issue, of course, does come up that you describe. Ramonet asks him direct questions about the issue of civil liberties in Cuba, political prisoners, the arrests of dissidents. And Castro is not at all generous to his enemies, but I think what you see in the book is that he has a very, very different definition of democracy than you or I do, and that many people in this country and around the world do. He tends to focus more on the rights of peoples to health care and to education, and not to the rights to free press and unionization and free speech. And voting, etc. And that certainly is addressed in the book. You know, love him or hate him, condemn him or praise him, and there are many people on both sides. The one thing you have to say about Fidel Castro is he has become a rather legendary figure and has been part of a rather incredible history over the last 50 years that involves the entire world.
What does he say about free speech?
Well, he believes that the press in Cuba is free because it's not owned by private corporate powers. As he points out, most of the press in the United States is, and that the press is speaking to the issues that involve Cubans. There's a whole chapter.
So his notion of a free press is that a government-controlled press is freer than a corporate-controlled press.
I'd say that's a good way of summing up his attitude. If it speaks to the issues that, of course, is told to anybody who's been to Cuba, knows that the press is very, very restrained and at times very archaic in its view of the world. And you'll find some rhetoric, same type of rhetoric that you find in the Cuban press. You'll find in some of Fidel's statements. But for the most part, the book is historic.
Right,
rhetorical.
Ideological.
Yeah.
June in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hello, June.
Good morning. Very, very happy to speak with you, and I'm terribly excited about this book. I happen to have been related to the wife of the Cuban consul from Cuba, Batista's consul to Florida, and I was at a dinner table when all of the revolution was taking place. The dining room table was surrounded by Secret Service people, and it was quite exciting. My personal feeling at the time was about 54, if I'm not mistaken. Can you correct me?
The Cuban Revolution was in 1959.
59. All right. I am 83 years old, so that puts me at 1924, 59, 35 years old.
You're 2 years older than Fidel.
I remember distinctly that we were very excited about Castro. Batista was a dictator, and my family were very friendly with them. They used to go to Havana and gamble, and it upset me mightily. These were not particularly nice people I was related to. They were gangsters. And I was rooting for Castro, and I think that America has treated Castro in the most ridiculous fashion. They have pushed him as they pushed Chavez, as they pushed Iran and Iraq and everybody, the same way. It's the corporate interests all over the world and the gangsters.
And funny, June, I'm going to leave it there, but historically, Peter, a lot of Americans at the time were rooting for Castro over Batista. The New York Times was. Ernest Hemingway was.
Brian, when I did the Bay of Pigs conference in Havana, I took a retired CIA agent who was head of the Cuba task force that was monitoring Fidel's progress during the revolution when his guerrilla movement was in the mountains. And he sat across, well, I took him in 2001 to Cuba. He sat across the conference room table from Fidel, and he said, you know, in 1958, when you were in the mountains, there were a bunch of us guys in the CIA that were rooting for you. He said, I was a Fidelista.
Because they expected him to be something different than he turned out to be?
Well, because Batista was, as your caller just pointed out, a well-known, brutal thug. Fidel Castro was young and to many, kind of a romantic figure. Cuba desperately needed change. It had become kind of the playground for the mafia and for the wealthy and for many U.S. corporations. There were a lot of people rooting for Castro and his movement.
And Bob on Staten Island wants to put an exclamation point on that. Bob?
Yeah, good morning. Happy New Year.
You too.
In early 1959, we gave Fidel a ticker tape parade in Manhattan. And everybody celebrated him. We thought he was, you know, this wonderful freedom fighter until we found out his true colors.
Is that true? Now, I don't even know that piece of New York history. Did Fidel get a ticker tape parade in New York?
I don't remember that he got it. He came to New York City in April of 1959. I don't remember him getting an official parade, but he went to Harlem, and certainly the crowds came out to celebrate him. He was a very popular figure in New York, and, you know, I have to say, he's not a popular figure in the United States today, but he's still a popular figure in many parts of the world.
Right. When he first defeated Batista, didn't he espouse elections?
He didn't really talk about democracy that much, but the CIA wrote a report that said he was going to be the new spiritual leader of democratic forces in Latin America. They couldn't have been more wrong about that. He, in the beginning, had a kind of a designated civilian president. And one of the kind of more comments that raises an eyebrow in his book is he says that he didn't want to be president in the beginning. Of course, he designated himself prime minister, and certainly he was the ultimate authority in Cuba. And eventually he did become take the title as president.
Peter Kornbluh, my guest on WNYC, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives, an independent research organization that advocates the publication of classified documents. He's been looking over a new book, which is kind of a spoken autobiography of Fidel Castro, called Fidel Castro, My Life, based on a series of interviews with a French journalist named Ignacio Ramonet. Kornbluh is organizing an excerpt to be published in The Nation later this week, and we're talking about the Castro life and legacy. And Jose in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jose.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. My parents emigrated here in 1960 from Cuba. My father's brother was killed by the Castro government or regime or whatever you want to call it. And I laugh at some of the things that I hear, such as like free health care and comparison. Like when people talk about Batista and how he became a brutal thug. I don't understand what you classify Castro as, considering he doesn't hold any free elections and doesn't allow his people internet access. And to this day, we still have to send medicine to our, cousins and distant cousins who write us constantly asking us to send them money and medicine. So hey, you could get health care in Cuba if you're a government official or if you're a tourist, but not if you're a Cuban citizen.
Did you see the Michael Moore documentary?
Yes, I did.
What'd you think of that? How he took American working class people down to Cuba where they could actually get health care?
Well, he got, again, I state, if you're a tourist or if you are a government official, it's very easy for you to attain health care. And it's probably pretty good. But if you're a Cuban there, you're not allowed in those places. Those are only places for tourists.
Jose, thanks for your call. And Peter Kornbluh, can you fact check that? And does he deal with this paradox about health care if Jose's version of events is accurate?
Well, Jose's version is not quite accurate. Cubans have basic health care, nutrition, prenatal care that is free and is heralded around the world. Castro spends a lot of time in this book talking about the health care issue. He's very proud of the fact that Cuba has trained many doctors, not only in Cuba but from around the world, and he actually predicts that Cuba will have 100,000 doctors by the year 2015, and will have trained another 100,000 from other countries around the world. By the way, even from the United States, where contingents of young students who can't afford to go to medical school here have enrolled in classes in Cuba. There is a tourism medical kind of sector. Jose is right about that. People do travel to Cuba to get certain surgeries that are far more expensive here. And those hospitals tend to be better equipped than the hospitals for the average Cuban. But Cuba's whole society truly is geared around kind of care for babies, prenatal care for pregnant mothers, milk allocations, and kind of the basic health care that most of the third world never sees.
We'll continue with Peter Kornbluh and your calls. A lot of Cuban Americans calling in. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget about our Iowa caucuses live coverage tomorrow night beginning at 8. I'll be anchoring with the reporting team of Iowa Public Radio. Working with us will be on in both states WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein, involved from Iowa as well. That's our Iowa caucuses coverage tomorrow night at 8 on 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org. We're talking about Castro now. This is the 50th year since the Cuban Revolution, and he has released kind of a spoken autobiography called Fidel Castro, My Life, based on a series of interviews with French journalist Ignacio Ramone. An excerpt will be in The Nation this week, as curated by Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives, an independent research organization. He's our guest. And Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to echo the previous sentiments of an earlier caller and how my family's also Cuban. And I grew up in this country, but I was taught since a very early age to really venomously despise Castro and everything that he had done. And as I grew older, I learned to appreciate, you know, what he had done for his country and educationally speaking and everything. Like, the literacy rate is higher than anywhere else. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I have an aunt who is a neurosurgeon who is actually a taxi driver now because she makes more money doing that than performing medicine. And people, and I have family members who have gone into the hospital sick and who have come out dead because there's no...
You're talking about in this country?
No, in Cuba.
Oh.
Because there's no equipment and there's no sanitation, and these doctors, they're really educated and they know what they're doing, but they have no ability to actually perform well because they don't have, you know...
the funding.
X-ray machines or
yeah.
even light bulbs or a sheet. So you have to take everything. You have to take soap. You have to take... any kind of disinfectant. And so what ends up happening is you have this incredibly overly educated population that has no access to really exercise the talents and skills that they've acquired.
So how much of the situation in Cuba do you credit or blame Castro for? And growing up with a very anti-Castro family and coming to see some of the good things, as you see it, about what he's done, do you wind up with kind of mixed feelings about Castro's legacy?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I was more of a Castro supporter, and I would never actually say that to my family.
And I won't tell them.
Really, maybe now they'll hear me. But I wanted to go to Cuba, and it's very, you know, looked down upon by my family, and I would never say that if I actually went. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is I feel that Castro, in his age, has become the very thing that he was fighting against, in the sense that he is very... you know, old worldly and old schooly, and he's more like my grandfather than the revolutionary that he sought out to be in the beginning, you know?
Jennifer, thanks so much for your call. We really appreciate it. Call us again. And John in Warrenton, Virginia, is that where you are?
I am indeed.
Thank you for calling New York Public Radio.
Right. I'd like Peter to talk a bit about what he thinks is going on now in Cuba in terms of the reform discussions that Raul launched, and what he thinks the impact is of what Congress does and the administration and what's said in the presidential campaigns. And it's, I mean, there's been very little said except in Florida and in the Brown and Black Forum of where the different candidates stand on Cuba.
Well, those are two separate questions, very distinct, obviously, what's going on in Cuba, what's going on in the United States. You know, what's going on in Cuba is Raul is trying to distinguish himself from his brother a bit by opening up a discourse. One of the things that was important in a letter that Fidel Castro wrote to the National Assembly just a couple of days ago and had read out loud, which is that he openly said, I am supporting Raul's effort to enhance, you know, the debate over the things that are plaguing our society, some of which were the things that your last caller, Jennifer, you know, talked about, which is the difficulty in supplies and medical supplies in Cuba. Particularly, there's the issue of transportation, there's the issue of housing. The New York Times just did a story about how difficult it is to get divorced in Cuba. It's easy to get divorced, but then there's no way to find a house to move into, so couples are ending up living in the same place even after they're divorced. And those are things that are being discussed. Interestingly, in this memoir, in this spoken autobiography, which, you know, Castro did a couple of years ago before he got sick, he states very clearly – that Cuba has to change again because we are in very difficult times. There are inequities that have been created and injustices. So he admits that there are real issues to be addressed in Cuba. And his brother is the one with younger advisors who are moving forward to hopefully make the changes without abandoning kind of the socialist principles that the revolution has basically obviously consolidated.
And do you personally, Peter, think that that can be done? I mean, we just heard from the previous caller, Jennifer, who is the daughter of Cuban Americans who are ardently anti-Castro, and she has come to appreciate some of the things that he's done, but also says, come on, the guy is so old school.
Well, let me just say, going back to John's second part of his question about the United States policy and the candidates, that I do think that Cuba can moderate and modernize its kind of domestic course with a different situation from the United States. This is 2008. We're going to have a presidential election here. It's hard for a lot of people to believe that after 50 years, the United States will pursue the same kind of policy of hostility and kind of an attempt to isolate Cuba.
Do you know if any of the candidates are on the record for wanting to change the policy or even lift the embargo?
Well, Christopher Dodd has called for the embargo to be lifted. Also Bill Richardson has been forward about saying that the embargo is a kind of an anachronism. They're obviously not leading the pack of Democrats. Among the top three, Hillary Clinton has basically assumed roughly the same position that George Bush has. I think it's more for political reasons than anything else. She wants to make sure that she wins Florida next time if
right.
she's the candidate.
There is that little Florida thing.
The 500 votes that George Bush won by in the year 2000. And Barack Obama has come out with a kind of what was considered a rather courageous opinion piece in the Miami Herald saying that we should have at least Cuban-American travel so that people like your caller Jennifer could freely go to Cuba. That's not really the most courageous statement given that we had Cuban-American travel up until 2004, even under George Bush, when he rescinded it to try and win Florida in the next election. So I do think that if you start to see a change in U.S. policy, which you'll see in Castro's memoir, he considers the most significant national security threat to Cuba, and you can understand that if you know the whole history, that there'll be at least space for younger generational leaders in Cuba now having the opportunity to rise up to make some arguments about changes in both domestic policy and in foreign policy towards the United States.
Peter Kornbluh, my guest on WNYC, talking about Fidel Castro, My Life, a kind of spoken autobiography by Castro. Kornbluh is editing a segment to be published in The Nation this week. And Alejandro in Roselle Park, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Morning, Brian. I am calling neither to praise nor to bury Fidel. I am calling basically because I think he's a figure that has undeniable historical importance. No one can deny the importance of the revolution, all the great progress on the front of healthcare and education. But at the same time, he has created a very militaristic, machista, closed society where individual rights are constantly trampled. I have to tell that I come from a socialist family of Cubans who fought for the revolution, and basically by 68, my family decided to leave because we felt they had become a kind of tropical version of Stalinism.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I just want to say that I believe the only presidential candidate that has been courageous has been Dodd. I think the embargo is anachronistic. I think there has to be a much more pragmatic way of dealing with Cuba. I mean, we can't have double standards. We deal with China that violates human rights more than Cuba at this point. And I just think that also my fellow Cuban Americans should have a much more long-term, pragmatic view about encouraging change in Cuba. So that's pretty much my comment.
Thank you very much. What's the biggest change you'd like to see in Cuba, Alejandro?
I would like to see a greater forum for free speech and for opposition groups to be able to gather and critique the revolution openly and demand reforms. And, it's interesting that 99% of the opposition groups in Cuba demand the lifting of the embargo. And yet Fidel, you know, accuses these people of being CIA agents.
Alejandro, thanks again for your call. Peter, do you think, and I know the embargo always becomes a source of big debate in the United States, do you think lifting the embargo would make a big difference to the quality of life of the Cuban people?
I do think that the lifting the embargo and having completely free travel and free trade between these two countries, would make a significant difference.
And I ask because look at all the Latin American countries that we do have trade and travel to and from between that have qualities of life for the average person at least as bad and in most cases worse than Cuba.
Well, one of the things is that Cuba, at least for the foreseeable future, is not going to abandon the kind of, you know, socialist ideology that governs the revolution. The influx of both tourism, the influx of investments from the United States, certainly there will be a dynamic there that is positive. But one thing to remember is that if relations normalize, if what Henry Kissinger once called the perpetual hostility in U.S.-Cuban relations changes, Cuba will adjust to not living under the shadow of the Goliath of the North, as Fidel likes to put it.
In fact, does Castro even want trade with the United States? I mean, the way that he rips free enterprise in this book repeatedly, you know, what would he think if American products were being shipped there and, you know, technology products and if hotels catering to Americans opened there? Is this consistent with Fidel's?
They would open under an investment agreement that would still give 51% at least ownership to the Cuban state, which is what the other investments from Spain and from China and from France
That's
and elsewhere
do.
But, you know, the real thing that Fidel Castro has always wanted is simply mutual respect and respect for Cuba's sovereignty. And he has said that repeatedly. And it's not about the influx of capital for him. It's about Cuba being treated in a kind of a honorable fashion of respect. And that is what the Cuban leadership has always said. That's why they've constantly harped on the embargo and lifting the embargo.
Right.
The United States in its effort to isolate Cuba with the embargo has only isolated itself. You just had a vote at the UN last October in which I think 182 nations voted to condemn the embargo, and only two or three voted on the side of the United States of America.
We're almost out of time. Is there anything new in this book about the Bay of Pigs or the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I wouldn't say that there's a lot new, but I think you get a detailed perspective from Fidel's own eyes, and those, particularly in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is a rather remarkable a thing to read. I've listened to him talk about this history, but reading it in a completely coherent way is quite remarkable. And, you know, one of the things that Ignacio Ramonet says in his introduction is, and I'm quoting now, is that few men have known the glory of entering the pages of both history and legend while they are still alive. Fidel is one of them. And for that reason alone, it's worth considering what he has to say, whether you condemn him or praise him, love him or hate him. He is a historical figure who has lived through some of the most extraordinary histories of our time and turned his country into a historical actor on the global stage.
There was a recent document, maybe since you deal with documentation you know about this, that said the CIA knew the Bay of Pigs invasion wouldn't work, but they didn't stop it, and also that the invaders expected to be greeted as liberators, and where have I heard that before?
Well, my organization, the National Security Archive, has pushed for the declassification of thousands of documents on the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. We don't push, as you suggested, to get classified information out. We push for information that is classified to be declassified and made public so that it can be examined for the sake of history.
Uh-huh.
And that is a true document that came out years later. It only came out 2 years ago, almost more than 40 years after the Bay of Pigs. We find out that CIA analysts knew and CIA operatives knew that it wouldn't work, and yet they not only didn't say so, but they misled the incoming president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, and pushed forward with a project that ended in disaster and certainly helped the Cuban Revolution kind of consolidate. In the very first meeting between a high U.S. official from the Kennedy administration and a Cuban official, it was Richard Goodwin, who was a Kennedy aide, and Che Guevara, who met in Uruguay. And one of the things that Che said to Goodwin was, "Thank you for the Bay of Pigs. You helped us consolidate our power, and you helped us become a nation with great respect around the world for defeating the Goliath of the North."
Peter Kornbluh, director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives, an independent research organization that pushes for the declassification of classified documents. And he's editing a segment of the new book, Fidel Castro, My Life, for The Nation this week. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, the lives of perfectionists. Are you one?